Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. So imagine for a moment that it is 1978.
Okay.
You take your dog out for a walk, right? And everything seems completely normal, but there is this sudden, terrifying biological storm brewing globally.
Yeah, a literal overnight pandemic.
Exactly. A brand new, highly fatal disease is just sweeping through the world's dog population. Veterinary clinics are overwhelmed. Puppies are, you know, incredibly vulnerable. And nobody has any idea where this pathogen came from.
Right. It just looked like a monster that materialized out of nowhere.
But the reality is actually much stranger. We're diving into a core mystery today that keeps virologists up at night. Like, how exactly does a virus living quietly in one species suddenly figure out how to infect a completely new species and trigger a global pandemic?
Yeah, because, I mean, the jump between species is basically the ultimate biological heist. Mm. Viruses are usually highly specialized. They're perfectly tuned to the biology of their specific host over thousands of years.
Right, they have their routine.
Exactly. So crossing over into a new animal means overcoming these immense physical barriers and entirely different immune systems. It is incredibly rare. But, you know, when it happens, the consequences are explosive.
And we are going to explore a textbook example of this mechanism in today's Geep Dive. We're talking about a virus that quietly infected cats for over 60 years. Then suddenly, in the 1970s, it just crossed over into dogs.
Which is wild to think about.
It really is. Think of this virus like a master thief who has been picking the exact same lock for decades. They know every single pen, every tumbler, and they can open that vault with their eyes closed.
Yeah, they have the perfect tools for it.
But then, seemingly out of nowhere, they suddenly figure out how to bypass a completely different, much more complex lock on a vault they have never even seen before.
And understanding how that thief acquired those new lock-picking skills is, well, it's the holy grail for tracking how pandemics emerge. It requires tracing, you know, molecular breadcrumbs left behind over decades of evolution.
Today we celebrate the work of Robert A. Lopez Escasio, Brian R. Wasik, Colin R. Parrish, and their team at Cornell University and collaborating institutions who have advanced our understanding of the evolutionary dynamics allowing epidemic emergence in new hosts.
The sheer scale of the historical and genetic data they brought together to solve this is just remarkable.
Oh, absolutely.
But to understand that terrifying canine outbreak in the late 70s, we really have to first look at the feline reservoir. So the virus in cats is called feline panleukopenia virus, or FPV.
Right. And how long has that been around?
Well, the historical record shows diseases matching the exact clinical description of FTV were reported in cats all the way back in 1887.
Wow, 1887.
Yeah. And then we saw large outbreaks again in the 1920s.
So the pathogen had been circulating in felines long before we had the tools to even see it.
Exactly. It had been a constant presence. But it was officially isolated in tissue culture for the first time in the early 1960s in the United Kingdom. And in a surprising twist, that very first physical sample didn't come from a house cat.
Oh, really? Where did it come from?
It was actually taken from a captive snow leopard.
Wait, a snow leopard? That's incredible.
Right. It really highlights how broad the feline susceptibility actually was.
Okay, so that's the cats. But then we fast forward to the mid-1970s, and the target shifts entirely to dogs.
Yeah, that's when we start seeing the timeline of canine parvovirus, or CPV.
Yeah.
Sometime in the mid-1970s, likely somewhere in Western Europe, a variant of that cat virus emerged in dogs.
And it moved fast, didn't it?
Incredibly fast. By 1978, a specific strain known as CQZ2 had spread across the entire planet. That was the massive pandemic that just devastated the global dog population.
And the evolution didn't even stop there.
No, it didn't. Between 1979 and 1981, that original CPV2 strain was completely replaced worldwide by a newer, fitter variant called CPV2A.
Okay, let's unpack this. If FPV has been circulating in cats since at least the late 1800s, and, you know, cats and dogs live side by side in almost every human settlement on Earth, why did it take nearly a century for the virus to finally breach that barrier?
Well, the answer lies in the microscopic architecture of the host cells. For these parvoviruses to infect a cell, they have to physically dock with a specific receptor on the surface of the host cells.
So going back to the analogy, you can think of this receptor as the specific lock on the vault door.
Exactly. And this particular receptor is called a transferrin receptor type 1, or TFR. In a healthy animal, TFR is just a membrane glycoprotein. Its actual day job is to help the cell absorb iron by bringing in a protein called transferrin.
Oh, I see. So the virus is essentially hijacking a door that the cell just leaves open for its regular food delivery.
That is the perfect way to visualize it. The virus exploits that specific cellular machinery. But here's the catch. The dog's version of this door, the canine TFR, has a really unique structural feature.
What's different about it?
Right at the apical domain, which is the outermost tip of the receptor that extends away from the cell surface into the environment, dogs have an extra sugar molecule attached to it.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, in biological terms, this process of adding a sugar is called an N-glycosylation.
So that extra sugar molecule acts as a physical shield. It is like the dog cells installed a security bar right over the keyhole.
That's exactly what it is. It physically blocked the cat virus from binding to the dog cells.
Yeah.
The viral shell just couldn't squeeze past that bulky sugar structure to attach properly.
The thief's old tools were totally useless against this extra layer of security.
Exactly. So, to figure out why that barrier was finally broken after a whole century, the researchers had to reconstruct a 60-year family tree of the virus.
They needed to trace the exact evolutionary steps the virus took leading up to that jump. How did they actually manage to do that?
Well, they started by sequencing 17 natural FPV samples dating back to 1964. And they analyzed those alongside 6 live attenuated commercial vaccines that are still currently used in veterinary clinics.
Right. They were looking for the exact branches on the family tree where the virus changed its strategy. So they compared 40 wild natural FPV genomes against a massive data set of 212 CPV genomes.
Yeah, tracking 47 years of parallel evolution in both animals.
I know they used some heavy computational methods for this, specifically Bayesian coalescence models running software called BEAST, alongside another tool called Tempest.
They did, yeah.
How do those tools actually help us read the past?
Let's break those down because they're fascinating tools. So Bayesian coalescence models, like BEAST, are essentially statistical time machines.
Statistical time machines.
Yeah, they use probability to look at the genetics of viruses existing today and then calculate backwards. If you have a group of related viruses, the software calculates the most probable genetic sequence of their shared ancestor.
Oh, and it estimates how long ago that ancestor existed.
Precisely. And then Tempest, on the other hand, measures what we call the root-to-tip genetic distance over time.
So if we imagine a literal family tree, the root is the ancient ancestor, and the tips of the branches are the modern viruses we sample today.
Right. Tempest plots the number of genetic mutations on a graph against the dates those samples were collected. If viruses mutate at a steady pace, you basically get a straight line heading upward,
creating a highly accurate molecular clock, basically letting us see exactly how fast the virus is ticking.
Exactly. But, you know, genetics is only half the story. They also needed to see the physical shape of the locks and keys. For that, they used AlphaFold 3.
Which is that advanced artificial intelligence system that predicts the three-dimensional folding structure of proteins, right?
Yes. And they combined that AI model with cryo-electron microscopy, or cryo-EM.
Cryo-EM is where they flash freeze the biological samples at incredibly low temperatures and fire beams of electrons at them to capture atomic level photographs.
That's the one. So by combining the AI predictions with these frozen snapshots, they could physically visualize how the mutated viral shell actually interacted with the canine receptor.
That combination of molecular clocks and structural visualization is what makes this research so robust. It lets you see the evolution in time and in physical space.
It really is a powerful approach.
Which brings up a really crucial part of their methodology. Why did the researchers have to be so incredibly careful to identify and filter out those commercial vaccine strains before running their evolutionary numbers through BEAST and Tempest?
Well, filtering the data is arguably the most critical step here. It addresses a major pitfall in tracking viral history.
How so?
Well, the live attenuated vaccines used to protect cats today were actually developed from viral isolates taken way back in the 1960s. And live attenuated means the virus in the vaccine is still technically alive and can replicate.
Right, but it has been weakened so it doesn't cause disease.
Exactly. But because these vaccines are widely administered everywhere, those 1960s viral sequences are actively shed by vaccinated cats into the environment.
I see. And occasionally researchers taking modern field samples will accidentally sequence the vaccine virus instead of the wild virus.
You hit the nail on the head. If you unknowingly include those vaccine sequences in a modern dataset, you are essentially dropping a 60-year-old virus into the 2020 timeline.
That would mess everything up. It would look like a modern virus that somehow miraculously underwent zero mutations over six decades.
Exactly. That would completely break your molecular clock. It would severely skew the natural timeline and make the mutation rates look completely inaccurate.
You would be confusing a museum replica of the thief's old lockpicks with the actual, highly upgraded tools being used on the streets today.
That's a great way to put it. Filtering out the museum replicas was totally critical to seeing the true speed of the wild virus's evolution.
And once those vaccines were cleared from the data, the true speed of evolution was revealed.
And the contrast they uncovered is just staggering.
Yeah.
When they calculated the substitution rates, you know, the speed at which the genetic code naturally changes over time, they found that canine parvovirus in dogs evolves 3 to 4 times faster than the feline virus in cats.
3 to 4 times faster is a massive biological shift.
It's huge.
The paper actually provides the exact scientific notation for this. For CPV in dogs, the rate is 2.18 times 10 to the negative fourth substitutions per site per year. But for FPV in cats, it's a much slower 0.578 times 10 to the negative fourth. To put that in perspective for you, while the cat virus might make one functional change over a few decades, the dog variant is mutating its surface every few years.
Yeah, it is basically the difference between taking a leisurely stroll and driving a sports car on the highway. Once the virus gets into the dog population, it completely floors the gas pedal.
So where did this fast-evolving canine lineage actually originate?
Well, the phylogenetic tree that calculated family history we talked about shows that the common ancestor of the rapidly evolving CPV lineage emerged from a specific group of clade B FPV strains circulating in Europe.
That is the crucial European connection.
Yeah. And the mechanism for making that host jump ultimately came down to just 12 key mutations on the branch leading to the pandemic CPV2 strain.
Only 12?
Just 12. And 9 of those were what we call non-synonymous substitutions falling within the open reading frame for the VP2 capsid protein.
Let's pause and clarify those terms for a second. An open reading frame is basically the specific stretch of genetic code that actually provides the instructions to build a protein, right? It is the blueprint, devoid of any filler DNA.
That's right.
And a non-synonymous substitution means a mutation that actually changes the final building block of that protein. It isn't just a harmless typo that goes unnoticed. It physically changes the structure of the resulting protein.
Exactly. That structural change is the key to the whole thing. The VP2 protein forms the outer shell of the virus, and specifically changes at amino acid residues the individual building blocks of the protein, like position 93 and position 323, were absolutely critical.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Let's visualize the structural change. The viral capsid, the protective outer shell of the virus, is incredibly tiny. It is a 26-nanometer T1 icosahedron.
Right.
If you picture a microscopic 20-sided die, like the ones you would use in a tabletop role-playing game, that is essentially the geometric shape of the virus.
I love that visualization.
Yeah. What the virus did was tweak just a few specific corners on that 20-sided die. By changing just those few specific residues on its surface, it altered its overall shape just enough to perfectly bypass the dog's extra sugar molecule and bind tightly to the receptor.
Yeah, the mutations altered the physical geometry of the capsid just enough to accommodate the canine TFR and slip right past its N-glycan shield. Mm-hmm. They basically picked the new lock.
That's incredible. But if we connect this incredible feat of adaptation back to the bigger picture, we find a massive contrast when we look at the original feline host.
We do, yeah.
That brings us back to those 1960s vaccine strains. You mentioned earlier that the FPV vaccines used today are derived from strains isolated in the 60s. Despite 60 years passing, those exact same vaccines still work perfectly to protect cats today.
And that stability is almost unheard of in modern virology. I mean, if you tried to use a flu vaccine or a coronavirus vaccine from the 1960s today, it would be completely obsolete.
Right, because the human viruses change their surface proteins so rapidly.
Exactly. But the researchers found there is very little selection pressure for antigenic variation in FPV. The virus in cats is evolving so slowly, and its surface proteins are changing so minimally, that antibodies generated by a cat's immune system against a 1960s strain can still easily recognize, bind to, and neutralize a wild strain circulating today.
The thief hasn't bothered to change their disguise in 60 years because the security guards in the feline world haven't needed to update their wanted posters.
That's exactly it. The baseline evolutionary rate for these carnivore parvoviruses in their normal adapted reservoir hosts is just remarkably slow. It is only when they jump the barrier that the entire dynamic shifts.
Which brings us to a huge question. If the virus already picked the lock, bypassed the sugar shield, and figured out the dog receptor back in the 1970s, why does CPV continue to evolve so rapidly today?
Well, you are touching on a core principle of evolutionary theory there called punctuated equilibrium. The virus existed in a highly stable, balanced state in cats for decades, if not centuries. To cross the barrier into dogs, it required a rapid burst of highly specific adaptations.
Those critical tweaks to the corners of our microscopic 20-sided die.
Exactly. But what makes this case unique is that once it successfully infected dogs, it didn't just settle down into a new stable state. The continued high speed of CPV evolution suggests there is intense ongoing selection pressure in dogs.
What kind of pressure forces a virus to keep sprinting like that?
Several hypotheses attempt to explain this. The first is the immune naivete of the global dog population at the time of the emergence.
Meaning they had zero pre-existing immunity.
Right. A massive worldwide population of totally susceptible hosts allows a virus to replicate and spread exponentially.
Yeah.
And when billions of viral copies are being made constantly, you get rapid evolutionary changes simply through sheer numbers.
Makes sense.
Another contributing factor involves differing epidemiological dynamics. Dogs just behave differently than cats.
Right, their pack behaviors, shelter environments, and population densities might drive faster viral turnover and continuous genetic drift.
Exactly.
Wait, if the CPV mutation rate is so fast right now because dogs were originally an immune-naive population in the 1970s, shouldn't that rate be drastically slowing down now that we are 50 years into the pandemic?
That's a great point.
You would expect the rate to plateau as the global dog population built up herd immunity through natural infection and canine vaccines.
That is a very sharp observation, and it cuts to the heart of why this research is so revealing. You absolutely would expect the mutation rate to level off.
But it didn't.
No. The fact that the CPV evolutionary rate has remained relatively constant and remarkably high since 1979 is what makes this dynamic so intriguing. It strongly suggests that the initial immune naivete was only the spark.
So what's driving it now?
Today, there is continuing host or antigenic selection happening. The virus might still be fine-tuning its physical interaction with the canine receptor to become even more efficient. Or, and this is more likely, it is engaged in an ongoing arms race, constantly dodging the canine immune response in ways it never had to do in cats.
It is like the virus is locked in a permanent high-speed arms race in dogs, constantly changing its disguise, whereas in cats, the virus and the immune system reached a comfortable truce a century ago.
Yeah. And the intensity of that arms race is even more impressive when you consider the virus' fundamental biology. The study points out that parvoviruses are single-stranded DNA viruses.
Oh, that's an important distinction.
It really is. Unlike RNA viruses, which copy themselves sloppily, DNA viruses are replicated by the host cell's own DNA polymerase. And that cellular machinery has a built-in proofreading function.
Like a molecular spell check that fixes errors during replication?
Exactly. Because of this spell check, the baseline mutation rate for DNA viruses is naturally about 10 times lower than what you see in RNA viruses, like influenza or coronaviruses.
A DNA virus should be biologically constrained to evolve slowly. The fact that canine parvovirus can still evolve this rapidly, completely fighting against its own spell-checking replication machinery, really highlights just how incredibly strong the selection pressure in dogs must be to force those changes through.
It really does. It's fighting its own biology to keep up.
Are there any missing pieces to this evolutionary puzzle?
Okay.
With all this data, did they find the absolute first virus that made the jump?
No, actually. That remains one of the tantalizing limitations of the current data.
Yeah.
The absolute patient zero ancestral virus, the perfect transitional strain bridging the genetic gap in 1970s Europe still has not been physically found.
So there is a missing link connecting the feline reservoir to the global dog pandemic.
There is. And finding that missing link requires hunting through archival dog and cat tissue samples preserved from that exact era in Europe.
Wow.
Yeah, we know through the molecular clock that the CPV ancestor emerged from a group of European EPVs. However, the European feline strains available in this data set were collected much later, between 2006 and 2016.
Ah, so genetically speaking, they are descendants of the cousins of the virus that made the jump, not the direct ancestor itself.
Exactly. To find the exact bridge, virologists really need to dig into veterinary tissue archives, specifically from the early to mid-1970s.
It is a literal biological treasure hunt through decades-old freezer archives. It is incredible how much a microscopic 20-sided dye, tweaking a few of its corners to bypass a sugar molecule, can tell us about global health and pandemic emergence. Comparing a virus's incredibly slow, stable evolution in its original reservoir host to its rapid explosion in a new host reveals that pandemics require a highly specific, rapid burst of adaptive mutations to cross physical species barriers.
Crucially, this deep dive shows that once that barrier is crossed, the new host environment drives continuous, accelerated evolutionary change. The jump itself is just the beginning of the story. The adaptation is an ongoing high-speed process.
What does this mean for our ability to track background viruses and predict the next big host jump before it happens? This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now, stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
Midnight on the bench, bright screens and quiet heat. A tiny shell of protein with a restless running beat. One line stayed steady, stitched in time like a scar. Another learned new angles just to reach a different door. Count the changes, watch the branches split. Some drift slow, some rush, won't ever quit. A small twist in the surface, a new fit in the frame, and the world looks different when the receptor knows your name. Capsid keys, turn the lock, cross the line. A host jump spark in the wire, up the spine. From a quiet cap on echo to a fast new wave. One set of mutations taught the virus how to brave. Capsid keys, now the outbreak won't wait. Protection close, still holds true. When the antigen hardly changes, the shield stays new. But read the warning in the adaptive shine. Track the edges where tomorrow spillovers align. Capsid keys. Find the next small change before it becomes an earthquake.